Now stay tuned for Straight Talk, the show where social justice meets criminal law. Brought to you on WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, by Tucker Griffin Barnes. Now here's your host, Andre Hakes.
Good morning, Charlottesville. You are listening to Straight Talk on WPVC-FM, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Straight Talk is a series of interviews and conversations about legal and social justice issues affecting our community. I am your host, Andre Hakes. On today's show, we're going to be talking with Jim Cohen, a UVA professor of psychology, about the formation and corruption of memory and how issues with memory can have effects on our legal system. Welcome, Professor Cohen.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here.
Well, I am so happy to have you here. I know a little bit about your background because I checked out your online resume at UVA before You have a CV. It's like 13 pages long. It's ridiculous. It's huge. And so I know that you have a PhD in clinical psychology with specialization in psychophysiology, measurement, and research methodology. Mm-hmm. What does that mean?
It means a lot of things. Means, you know, one of the things that I've been interested in a long time, really since the very beginning, is how our sort of psychological and mental life interacts with our physiological life.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, really, it's all physiology, right? Everything, you know, and people don't like to hear that, but it all sort of reduces at the end of the day to physiology. But we have this, you know, subjective mental experience, and we behave in certain ways that we can measure. And how does that all map on to the way our heart beats and the way that our skin, you know, secretes sweat and all of these kinds of things are interesting. How the brain functions.
When you're saying it's all physiology, it sounds like, you know, we're all a series of chemical reactions.
Yeah.
And that's our experience as a byproduct of those chemical reactions?
More or less. I mean, it's a lot more complicated than that because, you know, we also our brains and our bodies are prepared really to interact with the world. And so the part of our subjective experience of the world, part of the way we perceive the world, is a function of how our body is interacting with the world at any given time. It gets complex quickly, but that's why I got a PhD.
All right, Doc.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about when you. My understanding is that you achieved fame and notoriety early on in your education. Hey, we have something in common. On your Lost in the Mall experiment.
Yeah.
Tell me about. That's one of the main things I want to talk to you about on this show. Talk to me about how you got into that. What was the context in which you sort of designed this, and what you did, and just sort of go.
Well, it's a crazy story. I mean, I didn't set out to do anything like that. I had no particular interest in memory at all. I really did. What happened was I was going to university for the first time. I was a transfer student in from a community college.
So you were an undergraduate.
I was an undergraduate.
You were like one of our wahoos over here.
Yeah. So I went to the University of Washington in Seattle, and I didn't know what to do because I didn't know how to do university. I didn't know, mm-hmm. My parents had never gone to university. Nobody told me what to do. So when you're a transfer student from the community college back then, you could opt into a program where they would sort of help select your classes for you.
Right.
And I did that program because I was like, yeah, I don't have to think about it, and just put me in a place and I'll do stuff.
Uh-huh.
And so one of the classes that I wound up taking was a class by a professor, a psychologist named mm-hmm. Elizabeth Loftus. Beth, I call her Beth. And she, I didn't know this at the time, but she's sort of like the cosmic prodigy genius of memory research.
I saw many, many scholarly articles by Beth Loftus.
She's the real deal. And by the time I got into her class, she was already pretty much super famous for her research on something called the misinformation effect. How when you misinform someone about what they just perceived, what they just experienced, they'll often incorporate that misinformation into their memory.
What occurs to me in my sort of, you know, very minor pop psychology background is these experiments in, like, I think the 60s or 70s, where somebody would run through the room and in a gorilla suit and, you know, bouncing a basketball or something. And then they'd ask everybody what happened.
What happened? Yeah, there's a bunch of different versions of this. There are a bunch of different versions of this. And there, yeah, I mean, sort of, you know, eyewitness testimony research, you know, had already been, you know, pretty clearly demonstrating that eyewitness testimony wasn't particularly accurate. You know, it's, there's a lot of ways in which it can go wrong, and personal biases play into how you remember. You know, it's the whole thing about, you know, you see the you know, the white middle class you know, guy robbing a bank, and suddenly people are remembering it as a, you know, African American, you know, adolescent male.
Right.
What is that? I mean, why? And the reason is because we impute our expectations into our perception and experience. And
you see what you think you're going to see.
Yeah, you see what you think you're going to see. And there's other sort of manifestations of this, like, you know, the old game of telephone, where you sort of pass the story through a lot of heads down a chain of storytelling, and that same kind of cultural bias will bleed its way into the story until by the time you're at the end of the chain, you've got a completely different story.
Right. You start with, would you like to go out this weekend? And in the end, there's going to be a nuclear war.
Yeah.
Right. What?
Yeah, that kind of thing. I mean, inevitably, it's nuclear war. So I was taking this, class, and you know, I was learning all about memory per se. And she's a really engaging teacher, and at some point we started talking about this thing I didn't really understand, I didn't know about at the time, but it was very big deal in psychology and law, as you probably know. In the 80s and early 90s, there's still some vestiges of it, but back then people don't really remember that. Back then there was this belief in something called repressed memories.
Oh, it's very much still alive.
It is.
It's very alive in the legal system.
Yeah, I know. It's amazing because the mass of evidence that contradicts it is so massive now.
All right. Well, before we get into the massive evidence contradicting, I do want to talk about that, but yeah. I want to hear about this experiment.
Yeah.
Take me back. You're an undergrad in college in Seattle.
Undergrad.
You got Beth Loftus, who's this
doing.
Fabulous professor, and how do you end up doing this experiment?
So you know, she at some point she makes an offer for an extra credit assignment, and you know, this is really common at the time. It's less common now because. Partly because of this experiment, because it raised a bunch of issues regarding human subjects and ethics and
I saw some of that stuff online
and all of
too.
That stuff. This sort of came to a head with some of the stuff that we did in this. But you know, it was really common. You're taking a psych class. You want to have some laboratory experience,
sure.
quote unquote, right? So you do a little study and you write it up and you get some extra credit points. And what she suggested might be a neat thing to do for an extra credit assignment would be to get somebody to remember something that never happened.
And how
that
do you
blew
go
my
about
mind.
Getting
I mean, at the time I was like, what are you
something?
Talking about? But so how do you do it, right? This was the question.
Right?
So nobody knew how to do it.
Right?
There were books, there was an old book by a psychologist named Robert Lifton about false memories that would develop in China during the Cultural Revolution when they were being interrogated, and there, you know, there were things in the literature, and I had read, I was a big reader, so I had read Mark Twain a lot, and I by that time I had read this story by Mark Twain called The Man Who Corrupted Hadleyburg.
Mm-hmm.
You just really read it because the method for implanting a false memory really non-trivially derived from this short story.
Okay.
I'll tell you about that in a second. But also, you know, I used to play tricks on my siblings when we were kids and my parents. When you just deny a thing happened or you just assert a thing happened, my kids try to do it to me now. And it didn't escape my notice that sometimes it worked.
Right.
Like, oh yeah, I guess you did do that. So these things were already in my past when I was sitting there in this class and she was saying, well, I wonder if we could get somebody to remember something, not just remember something that didn't happen, but remember something that was mildly traumatic.
How do you get, how do you know if somebody remembers something that didn't happen or if they're just humoring you? I mean, how do you establish that somebody, you know, memory as opposed to, I mean, it's so subjective.
Well,
you can't measure memory.
Yeah, it is subjective and it's hard to do, but I'll tell you how we did it.
All right.
It sort of comes out in the story.
All right.
So So anyway, she suggested in class that maybe a mildly traumatic thing to remember would be being lost in a shopping mall. So that became that was the nugget.
Lost in the mall.
See if you can get someone to remember being lost in a mall. And write it up. She offered 5 extra credit points, and I needed them.
Okay.
I was not a terrible student by then, but I was not great either. So I wanted to get those extra points. So I devised this strategy, and the thing is, it just had never been done before. I didn't really know what I was doing. I didn't know. I mean, we had talked about the repressed memory controversy. Mm-hmm. And by the way, we should say for your listeners that repressed memories, the idea of repressed memories is that you experience a thing that's so horrible mm-hmm. that some little homunculus in your mind, some little deciding person,
all right, Mr.
deep
Young.
in your mind, right, just decides that you can't remember it.
Right.
It's too awful to remember it. So it gets locked away in some way that we don't know. We don't know how this could be locked away in some deep recess of your brain, and you in a sense forget it, but it's still there. And the idea is that while it's still in there, it's like a festering wound, and it's causing you to have all kinds of symptoms.
This sounds very Freudian somehow.
It is. It's entirely Freudian.
Okay.
And then one day, when you're sitting in the therapist talking about your misery, mm-hmm. which so many of us have done, the therapist suggests you. Well, I wonder if we're not going to get anywhere until we uncover the underlying cause mm-hmm. for these symptoms that you have, this misery that you feel, or your interpersonal difficulties, or your nightmares, or whatever it is.
Right. It's probably your uterus.
It could be that too.
Usually your uterus for
a long
time.
Uterus has some kind of thing where it gets a mind of its own and starts trying to claw its way out or something. I don't know. So the idea is that if you can find that memory, and you can bring it out into subjective conscious awareness, then you can start working on the trouble it's causing.
Well, that sounds kind of reasonable. I mean, it's still sort of part of the way we think about therapy in some ways.
Yeah, in some ways. I mean, they're
talking through something,
having coming to terms with it. But whatever it is, the thing is, you got to get in there with kind of a psychological crowbar
mm-hmm.
and get this memory out.
Okay.
Right. So how do you do that?
Right.
So this was the controversy that was going crazy in the legal system, because there were things like the statute of limitations in Washington State and other states was altered not to be, a period of time since the incident, but mm-hmm. the period of time since knowledge of the incident.
Oh.
Right. And that knowledge was your memory.
Right.
So the psychological concept of repressed memories was now impacting policy at the deep levels. It's so deep structural.
Basically
levels.
What I'm understanding you to say is there was this idea, and there still is this idea, I think, that people could have a traumatic experience, block that traumatic experience out of their consciousness.
Yeah.
And then years later, become suddenly aware of that traumatic experience again. And that the law, in recognition of this concept, at least in Seattle, changed regarding the reporting period for certain crimes.
Yeah.
And the thing we're mostly talking about here, the sort of the crime that you would hear about this in the papers and such, would be any kind of sexual abuse, child sexual abuse.
Yeah, that's the
boogeyman,
thing.
Right? And so you'd have a child sexual abuse experience, you'd depress it, and then sometime later in your adult life, maybe through therapy, it would come back to you. And the law said now not there's X number of years after this event for you to prosecute, but now there's X number of years after the memory of this event for you to prosecute.
That's right.
Okay, so substantive change based on that psychological concept.
Yep.
All right.
Substantive consequential change.
Mm-hmm,
big change.
Sure.
So it was a big deal, but I didn't really know. I was just a kid. I didn't really understand how fraught this was.
What'd you do? How'd you design your experiment?
So here's what I did. I designed these booklets.
Uh-huh.
That I asked, I was going to go to my family. I went to my sister and my brother and my mom.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked them to journal for me
mm-hmm.
for 6 days
mm-hmm.
about 4 different events.
Okay.
And 3 of them were things that had actually happened. And one of them was this lost in the shopping mall scenario.
Okay.
And the target of the shopping mall story was my brother. My brother, who I said, you know, when you were 5 years old, you got lost in the mall and we couldn't find you, and mom was looking everywhere for you and stuff like that. There were other things about, you know, things that we had been through that were mildly traumatic. I mean, not even mildly. Like, we had a house fire, and, you know, we there were other things that happened where we...
But those are real things.
They were real things.
And so you put this lost in the mall thing that never happened in sort of a basket, if you will, in a kind of a package deal with these three things that did happen.
Yep. And I asked these three family members to journal about those four things.
Were they supposed to talk to each other about them?
They weren't, but I didn't. I don't remember if I explicitly told them not to either. But the idea that I had, the thought that I had, and this come this is just in that like that Mark Twain story, the man who corrupted Hadleyburg, was that the suggestion in the first few days would sort of pop into their head, and as they so here's what I did. I in the instructions for the journaling, they could only journal for a few minutes every day, and if something occurred to them, they couldn't write it down. They had to keep it in mind until the next day.
Okay, all
right. So in that sense, I was asking them to rehearse it in their minds.
Right.
And that,
go
that
over
my,
the story.
My belief was that that would be writing the memories, right? Because you're actually utilizing memory to write the story.
What happened? How did the experiment turn out?
Well, my sister hates it when I say this, but she didn't do it right, so we had to throw hers out. She ruined it.
What did she do?
She just, I don't know what she did. I can't even remember what she did, but I was like, oh, come on. Sorry, Sandy. And then my mom, she filled it out dutifully. Mm-hmm. She never remembered the false event. So she served as kind of an interesting control.
She sort of said, talked about the details of the three things that had actually happened, and
what she did on the Lost in the Mall one, she basically wrote things like, I feel bad. I'm such a terrible mother. I can't remember this. You know, oh, God. You know, I sort of caused her guilt.
Right.
Which is, you know, that's
which she was assuaged 6 days later.
Yeah, right. Actually, no, because I'll tell you what happened.
Oh, okay. All right. Longer.
It was longer. I made everybody sweat for a lot longer. My brother started remembering the false event almost immediately. Now, the thing that's interesting about that is that he was the target.
Now, how old was your brother at the time?
At the time, he was 14.
So your brother was 14 years old, and you said when you were five.
When you were five, you were lost in the mall.
Okay.
He started remembering... you know, mostly he was at least reporting in the journaling that he was remembering what I'd suggested.
Okay.
And I have all these things at home. I have all these original journals and things. So I was kind of excited. He seemed to be remembering the suggested false memory, but he was also remembering the other things. So, it was moderately exciting to me. I took it to Beth Loftus, because I was going to.
You were like, "Hey, check this out!
Hey, check this out! I'm going to get
my five points,
slam dunk!" And she went. I mean, she responded dramatically. I mean, this is a big deal. It's a much bigger deal than I realized.
Okay.
So she was. She called in some grad students, and she called some other faculty. She's like, "This thing happened." You know, this kid is remembering being lost in the mall.
Right.
When he was five, this mildly... What she asked me to do was go back. So I hadn't debriefed them.
Right.
I didn't even know.
You didn't
know what
tell
a debriefing
them.
Is? A debriefing is when, after a person, participates in an experiment, you talk them through why you constructed the experiment. You sort of work with them to understand their experience, and you make sure that they feel okay and things like that. I didn't really know what a debriefing was. I didn't know about experiments. I didn't know about research. I was going to maybe try and go to med school. I didn't know what I was going to do. I was taking a bunch of math classes. So I didn't prepare a debriefing. And what Beth asked me to do was to go back and interview my brother about these memories.
All right, I'm going to stop you right there for a second because we need to take a break.
Okay.
And we'll be right back, and then we will hear about your interview of your brother.
This is the sound of a bully at school.
Where'd you get the shirt? Colorblind and things?
And this is the sound of a kid telling her parents about the bully. If you don't hear about it from your kid, that doesn't mean it's not happening.
McGruff the Crime Dog here about how parents can tell if bullying is upsetting their children. Kids may avoid school. Grades may suffer. Stop bullies with words to your kids, school officials, or other concerned parents, and at McGruff.org.
A message from the U.S. Department of Justice, Crime Prevention Coalition of America, National Crime Prevention Council, and the Ad Council.
Now stay tuned for Straight Talk, the show where social justice meets criminal law. Brought to you on WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, by Tucker Griffin Barnes. Now here's your host, Andre Hakes.
Hello, Charlottesville. I'm Andre Hakes, and you're listening to Straight Talk on WPVC. My guest today is Jim Cohen, who is a UVA psychology professor, and we are talking about memory, repressed memory, memory corruption, memory formation. And Jim, you were just about to tell us about what happened when you went back to interview your brother about this experiment that you had him do.
Well, you know, he again remembered the false event, but in far more detail. This was a couple of months after he'd filled out the booklet. You know, it was after my class was over with Beth, mm-hmm. and I asked him at some point I didn't know what to do. He's telling me all of these new memories about the event.
What kind of new memories?
So he's imputing things. He's saying, well, he's giving me details about this old man who found him. And
was there an old man in your story?
Yeah, there was, but not in as many details. Not when he was fleshing it out.
What kind of details?
What he was wearing, the color of his clothes, the things that he said, the things that my mom said when we found my mom. You know, all of these things he was just inventing. But they made sense. They made narrative sense, mm-hmm. given the scenario. And that's so he was using conceptual knowledge about what happens when you get lost and mm-hmm. someone finds you, and you know, sort of channeling that into the creation of a memory. But,
right.
but what I did was, you know, at some point he was going on so long, my mind was blown, and I had a tape recorder mm-hmm. rolling. Mm-hmm. So the tape mm-hmm. is rolling. I didn't know what to do. I hadn't prepared a debriefing. I didn't know what to tell him.
I
was going to just drop this bomb on him
right.
at one of these. And so I just finally went straight forward and I said, you know what, Chris, one of these four memories that you've just discussed in great detail,
mm-hmm.
Is false.
Right.
I made it up. Well, I didn't even make it up. My psych professor made it up.
Uh-huh.
Can you tell me which one?
What did he say?
He guessed the wrong one.
Wow.
So he couldn't distinguish in his subjective experience the false memory from the true ones.
Wow. Okay.
That's pretty incredible.
That's pretty intense. So
yeah.
What did you do? Did you go back and...
I brought the tape to Beth Loftus, and the world exploded. So she took it to a conference, I think, in San Francisco. She took it to a few other conferences. She played the tape
mm-hmm.
for large audiences of people. It wound up showing up in places like the New York Times science section. This was not my expectation. My expectation was five extra credit points
on your grade?
I uh-huh. didn't really understand the degree to which such a demonstration had not really happened before
mm-hmm.
In a deliberate sort of experimental way. Now, it's interesting because it's just, it's in science we say it's an N of one. It's only one subject.
Right,
right?
Sure.
So you know, what you can conclude
could
from something like that.
Could be your brother is extremely suggestible. And
right,
of
right.
a fanciful turn of mind.
But it's sort of, people talk about these kinds of things as existence proofs. You know, the thing can happen. So let's see under what conditions it happens, how often, and stuff like that. So, yeah, it went crazy. It was in the media all over the place. I was originally going to do what's called an undergraduate honors thesis with a guy named John Gottman, who I wound up doing a lot of work with
mm-hmm.
Later on. But because of the explosion in interest in this memory finding with my brother, people were calling it around the department. They were calling it the Chris study. My brother's Chris Cohn. They're saying the Chris study or the shopping mall study. And so I wound up doing an honors thesis with Beth Loftus where I replicated this in several people.
Oh, you did it again?
Oh, yeah, we did it again. It was a huge, absurdly huge research undertaking for an undergraduate.
How many people did you do this with?
I can't remember right now.
Did you know them all, or were some of them
strangers? No. What I did is I recruited undergraduates like myself at the time as research assistants, and then had them basically do the same experiment on their own families.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I don't know how the IRB, the Internal Review Board, let us do this, but they did.
Probably because getting lost in the mall wasn't a horrible...
Well, when we first submitted the application to do the research, it was soundly rejected, and you know, 6 pages or so of comments. And it took a long time to respond to all of their criticisms. And it, you know, it would take a lot more of your time than you have to describe
all of it. It's funny. I was talking to my wife this morning before I came in to do this show, and she asked me what my show was going to be on today. And I was giving her a thumbnail sketch of this, and her first comment to me was, they let him do that?
Yeah, right? Yeah, it would be an interesting thing to try and submit the same application today.
See what happens.
See what happens. I think the IRB would catch on fire or something. It just wouldn't do that.
Okay, so you replicated this study.
Yeah.
What kind of sample size?
You know, I can't even remember, but it wasn't large. It was an undergraduate honors thesis. And then...
Are you talking you had 5 other people
do
this?
No, something like 12 or, not much.
Okay.
And then Beth and another student later on after I left, because, what happened was I kind of had a terrible time. As soon as this finding went into the media, mm-hmm. I got a heaping dose of why it was so controversial.
Why?
It just raining down on my head.
Tell me about your hate mail.
So, it's a long story. There are a lot of reasons for this, but I was working at the time also at the Seattle Crisis Center. I was taking calls from people in crisis. And, you know, it was a bunch of psychologists there.
Mm-hmm.
And when the study started getting press, it was very unpopular mm-hmm. among a lot of them. And people started getting really angry at me.
You said the world was round, didn't you?
Yeah.
That was a mistake.
And the funny thing was that it wasn't even really me. It was Beth. Beth was the expert. She was the one who was really talking about it. I had just done this extra credit assignment.
Sure.
And was trying to do my honors thesis. And I thought it was important. I mean, if it's really true that you can create memories for a thing that never happened, we ought to know about that, don't you think? As a defense attorney.
Certainly as a defense attorney, I think we ought to.
We ought to know that.
But I know a lot of people on the prosecution side who probably would have been in the hate mail camp.
Yeah. Yeah, and a lot of people who believed that they had repressed memories of childhood abuse. You know, one of the things that hurt the most during that time was the accusation that people like Beth and I, because I was doing this study, we denied the existence of sexual abuse, which is absolutely insane.
Right.
Because, of course, we don't do that. It absolutely happens, and it's heinous. And it needs to be both prosecuted and eliminated to the degree possible. And this has nothing to do with the question of memory per se, except that if the experience is based on a false memory, then all kinds of problems arise. Not just for people who might be accused, but for people who are generating the memories.
What would have happened if you cross-examined your brother about that memory, if you sort of aggressively questioned him in a hostile tone about it?
I have no idea. I mean, part of it is that I don't really know how to do that, right? I'm not a lawyer. I tend to avoid legal settings.
Wise, very wise.
I've been asked to testify as an expert witness about this, and I've just never agreed to do it because I don't want to do it. I don't want to be there.
Well, I imagine it was a very unpleasant experience to get all that pushback.
It was,
and
it was pushback in a lot of different ways. I, you know, my academic undergraduate counselor gave me crap about it. The graduate students in the clinical psychology program gave me a bunch of were hostile to me.
Mm-hmm.
People at work at the crisis center were very hostile to me.
Is it because you must be a misogynist or you must hate children?
Yeah,
I'm
some kind of reactionary conservative, anti-feminist.
Ooh,
that was a charge that came up quite a bit. And strange things happened, you know, because it wasn't only professional people who got upset, but it was also, you know, alleged victims,
right?
You know, or people who believed that they had had these experiences and they were based on repressed memories, and they were re-traumatized was the word. They were re-traumatized by the work that I was doing.
Well, certainly, if you had someone who had recovered a memory like this and had actually recovered repressed memory, whether or who just thought they had, either way you look at it, whether they did or they didn't, you know, you have suddenly called into question a something major that has happened in their lives. Usually, yes. If somebody has this experience, they've then distanced themselves from family members or cut themselves off completely or confronted their, you know, alleged abuser, or maybe someone went to prison. And when you say to somebody, it's kind of like those DNA exonerations, right? You got somebody who thinks they identified their rapist, and then 20 years later, they find out it's not the guy. You know, A, first, they can't believe it, and B, you know, it's just very difficult to accept. It makes you the bad guy that you did this to someone. Yeah. And I imagine there was a lot of pushback from that.
There certainly was. And you know, all this time, of course, Beth Loftus is this sort of quintessential eyewitness testimony expert witness for the defense.
Right.
It's one of the titles of her book. One of her books is Witness for the Defense. And so she immediately, as far as I know, I mean, this was evidence in court.
Mm-hmm.
These studies.
Well, how could it be evidence in court? That probably took some time to peer review it, right? I mean, they had to be recreated.
Well, that's one of the controversies about the study.
Well, let's talk about it.
It didn't really get that peer review.
Why not? Were people afraid to do it, or did they try to do it and it failed?
I don't know who else tried to do it at the time.
Mm-hmm.
I know that since then, this is now 25 years ago.
Right.
Since that time, it's been replicated in a variety of ways, hundreds of times, maybe more.
So it got peer reviewed.
It did,
but just
it did
not,
get peer reviewed,
it
but
wasn't
not
at the time.
Time.
Right.
Not at the time. It was really, I mean, really, it was a one subject anecdote.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was this huge amount of pressure to do just what you're talking about, mm-hmm. to do the formal study and get it out into a peer-reviewed journal. It was enormous pressure.
Mm-hmm.
And I cannot express to you how much I had no idea what to do or how to do it. There's no way for me to overstate my ignorance at that time. I was a working-class kid who'd gone through community college. I was older because I'd spent time off working in grocery stores and you know, in factories, and I was roofing with my stepfather. You know, this is the kind of stuff that I knew.
Mm-hmm.
And I decided to go back to school because I didn't want to get heat stroke anymore up on roofs, and I hated labor. I want to do easy stuff like psychology.
Like think?
Yeah, like thinking. And so I had no idea what to do. So the combination of how fraught and important this was and the necessity with which we had to do something more formalized and more legitimate for a peer-reviewed journal,
mm-hmm.
and my ignorance of how to do any of the above, I mean, I didn't sleep for 2 years. I developed like this skin disorder on my skin because I was always, you know, so anxious, and I wasn't sleeping, and I was, you know, I felt like I was losing friends at the community the crisis clinic, and it was just a really hard time.
Well, and it ended up not being the direction your research ultimately went. I mean,
well, because I completely rejected it. At some point after 2 years of not sleeping, of stressing out all the time, knowing that I'm making Beth Loftus just wait and wait and wait, because I didn't know what I was doing. But mm-hmm. she's busy. She's going and teaching classes and traveling all over the place, you know, mm-hmm. doing expert testimony and all of these kinds of things.
Well, why didn't you do it? I mean, you were just a student. You did this thing, had a surprising finding. Why didn't she do the next one?
She couldn't. She was too busy.
Okay.
So, but what she did do was provide me with a lot of resources. And there were graduate students there that I could have gotten help from. But, you know, I didn't understand how academia worked. I didn't know what... At the most basic levels, I didn't know who to ask.
Right.
I didn't know how to collaborate. I didn't know how to do anything. You know, I'd come to school dressed in my sweatpants and I had this, like, Mexican poncho thing that I would wear. You know, I looked like a crazy person. I didn't know what I was doing. I was living in a house with 10 people, you know, renting a room that was dilapidated, had no heating in the wintertime.
Otherwise known as you were a college student.
I was a college student. But I was acutely ignorant, even by the standards of most college students. And so it was too stressful. And then things would happen, like a new grandparent couple would be accused, mm-hmm. based on a repressed memory. And it would become part of the thing that we would talk about in the Loftus Lab. And, you know, it would be, you know, we'd review the case and discuss it. And it would just be very clear that this was based on a false memory,
mm-hmm.
and they would go to jail, and just the pall over the lab that would come in, the dark clouds, it seemed just impossible.
Well, how did you decide when you say it was very clear? Nothing in the law is ever very clear to me.
That's good.
What did you know about cases like that when you would look into them and you'd say, well, this is clearly a false memory case. How did you distinguish?
Because what you'd see, so for example, there was one case that became kind of celebrated. It was written up by Lawrence Wright, this science writer for the New Yorker at the time. This guy named Paul Ingram, who was accused of not just molesting his children, but widespread satanic ritual abuse. Another one of these things.
Okay.
No evidence for this, right? There's just no. The FBI has spent enormous.
They didn't find the burning pentagram and the
or the field full of baby babies that had been buried after sacrificing them, and you know, on and on. I mean, it goes on and on and on and on and on.
Uh-huh.
And it was really clear that what would happen is they were keeping him isolated.
Uh-huh.
They were having a specialist, a psychologist who specialized in.
Oh, in other
memories.
Words, this was coming from him.
Yes,
he was confessing to these things.
He confessed to these things. And when you looked at the kinds of things he would confess to, and in fact, eventually this guy named Richard Offshee, he was I think a sociologist from Berkeley who specialized in sort of cult deprogramming. And he came up. He was a consultant for the prosecution to help them
uh-huh.
get these memories out.
Uh-huh.
And he saw what was happening. You know that they would suggest these things, and then he would think about it for a few days, and then he would start to remember it. So he surreptitiously, secretly, created his own accusations that were not coming from the kids or from the and knowing that they were false, like a little version of the
right.
experiment I did with my brother, and he suggested them
threw him out there, and he said, "Oh yes, I did that."
After a few
wow.
days, and he was prosecuted based on these kinds of
wow.
things.
Wow,
he was successfully convicted.
Did he go to prison?
What?
Did he go to prison?
He did.
Did it ever get overturned?
Nope.
Is he still in prison?
I think he's out now. He might
oh,
have
my
been
God.
But, you know, at the time, the thing also that blew my mind is that organizations like the American Civil Liberties Union, they wouldn't touch this.
Why not?
Because it was about
child sexual abuse. And this is the Salem witch trial, right? You can't
yeah.
say
because
they're not a witch or you must be a witch, too, right?
People get accused of that. I mean, people that go through it
right.
suffer unimaginably. People who get accused of it falsely, they're at the bottom of the ocean. They're not. There's nobody who wants to really defend them.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I shouldn't say there's nobody. And I don't really know because I'm probably going to get a bunch of hate mail. Like, it happens whenever I talk about this, which is part of why I don't do it.
Mm-hmm.
So at some point at the end of this, I had to defend an honors thesis. At the University of Washington, if you did your honors thesis, you had to do a defense. You had to present it. It was my very first presentation ever. And I was terrified because there were so many people that I knew wanted me to just go down in flames. And the room filled up more than usual for these kinds of things. And it went pretty much okay. I dropped all my slides. I bumped my head on the projector when I was standing back up. It was one of those overhead projectors then, right?
We
didn't have PowerPoint. But then it was over and I was like, you know what? Heck with this. I'm not doing this anymore. I can't. If I do this for another day, I'm going to die. I couldn't. It was too stressful. And so I left the project and went straight into doing research on relationships and emotion.
Well, I looked at some of your more current research. I see there's a TED Talk Charlottesville TED Talk from you on holding hands.
Yeah.
And in thinking about the physiology, I want to say I read a study that you had done involving a group of people who were either holding their husband's or wife's hand, holding a stranger's hand, or holding no one's hand, who were then told they were going to receive an electric shock.
Yep.
Tell us about that. What was that experiment? Did you actually zap anybody? Or
We shock people all the time.
Okay. So tell me what did your study show?
Well, so now what I really do is I study something called social affect regulation, and only very recently we're realizing that it's kind of taking me full circle back into memory a little bit, which is totally unexpected, but I'll explain why.
The stars are aligned here for you, Jim.
Yeah, I can't get away. It's like the mafia. The thing that we study now is really how, you know, if you and I are in a relationship and I'm feeling threatened or stressed out by something in my life, how you regulate my emotional response.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really important because we've known for many decades, if not millennia, that people who have good social relationships, they live longer, they're happier, they get sick less often, you know, they're even less likely to die at any given moment. So the question is why? Right, and there's a lot of reasons maybe for why. There's some instrumental reasons. So you watch out for me. You tell me to wear my seatbelt. You know, you make sure I take my medications. You know, if I forget.
But I also apparently hold your hand while you get shocked.
That's right.
Talk about what you did. And
so there's this direct physiological regulation when you're under stress, when mm-hmm. you're under threat. And this is part of why I was having like skin problems and things because I was so stressed when I was doing the memory study. You release stress hormones,
mm-hmm.
and the function of those stress hormones is essentially to redistribute your body's resources from one place to another, and the place that's taking resources from, immune system, which is a huge resource hog.
That's why you get sick when you get too stressed out.
Glucose stores in organs throughout your body, and they're basically dumping. You're taking those resources and dumping them into your bloodstream.
Mm-hmm.
Why are they doing that? Because you perceive a threat, you're going to have to deal with that threat.
Right.
And so you want to have all the resources available.
Sort of a fight or flight adrenaline type thing.
Right. And that's great. If your house is burning down, it's not time to, you know, work on that leaky faucet. You got to keep your house from burning down. Thing is, if you think your house is burning down chronically over long periods of time, you never fix your leaky faucets. And then it's not just the leaky faucet; it's the HVAC is getting pretty crummy, and you've got another leak in the roof, and pretty soon, it's the house is falling down.
All right. Well, we'll be right back in just a second with Jim.
You're invited to join Virginia Organizing in fighting for social justice issues like immigration reform, restoration of rights, and Medicaid expansion. Virginia Organizing is a statewide grassroots organization dedicated to challenging injustice by empowering people in local communities to address issues that affect the quality of their lives. Virginia Organizing especially encourages the participation of those who have traditionally had little or no voice in our society. For more information, call 434-984-4655. Again, that's 434-984-4655 or visit our website at virginia-organizing.org.
Now stay tuned for Straight Talk, the show where social justice meets criminal law. Brought to you on WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, by Tucker Griffin Barnes. Now here's your host, Andre Hakes.
You are listening to Straight Talk on 94.7 WPVC. I'm Andre Hakes, and my guest today is Jim Cohen, professor of psychology at UVA, and we are talking about memory. And we had just moved into sort of the physiology, social
affect regulation, emotion regulation.
That thing you said.
Yeah, that thing I said.
So I want you to get to what you did in this study with the hand-holding thing.
Yeah, well, so how do you keep me from thinking that my psychological house is on fire.
Okay.
Right? And that whole stress response. We wanted to simulate that in the brain scanner. We wanted to see if we could find the brain mechanisms of how you regulate me.
Mm-hmm.
And so in order to do that, the first thing we had to do was got to stress out the system.
Mm-hmm.
So we put people in the brain scanner and we put them under threat of electric shock
mm-hmm.
over and over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
And what that allows us to do is to see what their brain is doing under mm-hmm. threat of electric shock. That's we're going to see how their brain is going to start the process
mm-hmm.
of preparing for threat.
So you put people in a scanner and you said, we're going to zap you.
We're
going to
zap you.
Okay. And then you scanned and saw what happened in their brains when you told them they were going to be
their
zapped.
Their brains become, there's a sort of stereotypic neural response to threat that many people have documented in many studies over the years. And we see the same thing. So we see the brain gearing up. We see activations, we call them activations mm-hmm. in the brain in places like the hypothalamus and mm-hmm. the insula and the prefrontal cortex. I mean, it's not that important to know about these structures unless you're me, right? But the important point is that parts of the brain that should be responding to threat are.
And you did this with three separate groups of people.
Same people in three different conditions.
Oh, same subject.
Yeah, so
three different conditions.
We call it within subjects design.
All right, so what were the three conditions?
The three conditions were being there by yourself,
mm-hmm.
holding hands with your spouse in the mm-hmm. original study, mm-hmm. or holding hands with a stranger.
Okay.
And the short story is, when you're holding hands with a stranger, your brain's a little less active
mm-hmm.
In response to the threat.
Mm-hmm.
So you derive some benefit, apparently, in terms of managing your threat response, even from holding hands with someone you've never met before, and you've never even, you don't know.
Right.
But if you're holding hands with your spouse, you derive a huge benefit. So the regions of the brain that are normally responding to a threat cue, a threat of shock,
right,
in the context of being in a scanner, which is itself an aversive experience,
right,
they're far less active in regions like the prefrontal cortex, the anterior insula. I mean, these
right.
places that I was talking about. And so
basically, people holding their honey's hand when they're told something bad's going to happen to
yeah.
you, are comforted.
They're comforted.
Not surprising.
And that has probably some pretty important physiological consequences. I mean, we were talking about the metaphor of the house earlier. And what that really is doing, when your sweetie's holding your hand, you perceive yourself having more time to work on the leaky faucets in your body or the
right.
to take care of yourself instead of preparing for an emergency.
Right. Okay, I got it. And how does this sort of loop back around into the memory research you
right.
were originally doing?
So how does this loop around in a way that feels, it's fascinating. So the reason this works is because mm-hmm. dealing with stress, dealing with anything, is effortful. And human brains try to minimize effort. They try to minimize effort whenever they can. They try to cut corners
mm-hmm.
because life during evolution was incredibly hard. Resources were very hard to find. You're just going out the door. So any opportunity to cut costs was an opportunity that you could take.
Mm-hmm.
And one way you could cut costs in regulating your threat response was to outsource the regulation to your honey, right?
Right.
But guess what else is costly?
What?
Memory.
Memory is costly.
Memory is costly.
Memory
too.
Uses a lot of mental resources.
Memory uses mental resources. And there's a lot of opportunity in life to forget important things,
mm-hmm.
right? So guess what we do? We outsource memory to our social networks.
How do we do that?
By having shared experiences, and you'll remember some part of it, and I'll remember some other parts of it, or you'll tell me what happened, and I'll believe you.
So this is sort of, in a way, related to having the family members do this memory experiment
yes.
together.
Yes, the family members are remembering for you. And this is not work that I did. This is, and interestingly, this is something called, it's called transactive memory, and it was written by a guy named Dan Wegner going back to the 1980s. So this is kind of a relatively old concept, but it's woefully understudied and underappreciated. The degree to which humans will outsource labor with their bodies, labor with their minds, cognitions, any kind of thing, the temperature. So we huddle together in order to to conserve temperature. Body temperature is called social thermoregulation. These are things we are intensely social, and it seems incredible to believe that our memories could reside in a relationship or in a social network, but it's really true. And if it wasn't true, we wouldn't be as successful at remembering things. When you think about your own relationship as you go forward through time, you start developing specialties. You might specialize in cooking, and someone else might specialize in laundry, or you might specialize in remembering, where the fuse box is, or someone else, she might specialize in remembering to get the car oil changed. All of these things, we start distributing labor non-redundantly in order to make ourselves more efficient, and our relationships increase our efficiency dramatically using what economists call economies of scale. So an economy of scale is sort of like there's exchange economies where you give me a thing and I'll give you a thing, and we go back and forth, and that's not really the way that relationships work. Relationships work by you and I forming a bond, sharing a goal, and then pooling resources towards that goal.
Sort of a symbiosis.
Yeah. And by pooling our resources towards that goal, it's like when you get, and we'll use a house again. If you are alone in a house, you have the rent for that, you're paying, the rent, and you're paying for the utilities, and you're paying, and the thing is, you bring another person into that house, you bring all their resources into that house, and the expenses actually don't go up that much. So you realize this economy
is scaling. This is why college students live together.
That's right.
Right.
It works. And relation, and that metaphor of the house, that's not even really a metaphor. That's literally true about the house is cheaper when you have another person. But the thing is, remembering things is cheaper. Regulating your emotions is cheaper. Taking care of your health is cheaper. Attending to the car is cheaper. All of these things become a little bit cheaper for similar reasons.
I know that we have sort of family stories, right? In our families, we develop, an event happens, and then the event is retold.
Yeah.
And then the event is retold, and is retold, and the different family members tell each other the event, right? And over time, you develop a sort of a legend, right? A family legend of an event. And it's a collective memory, is kind of
Absolutely.
What it is. But sometimes it's not accurate. Because it has become an amalgamation of everyone's memories over time.
It's almost certainly not accurate.
It becomes something not really what happened.
Right. As a matter of fact, there's some funny ways in which false memories are healthful. They're the thing that you want. Mm-hmm. Because here's the other thing that happens with normal false memories. Mm-hmm. They favor us. They make us look better.
Right.
Right. So there's these lovely experiments. They're hilarious. You have people keep a journal while they're on vacation, and they're like, my mom's being a pain in the rear end. And, the weather wasn't as good as I thought. And the restaurant is kind of, the fish was gummy.
People write
these things. They complain, and it wasn't that great. Then you take their journals from them so they don't read them anymore. And you ask them, say a year later, to remember that vacation. Oh, it was great. Such a bonding time for me and mom. I'm so glad we had that time, and the food was amazing, and the warm breezes blowing off the ocean. They didn't write any of that.
Doesn't it sort of depend on what the tone is of the group with whom you had the experience too, though? I mean, this is why that Facebook experiment recently was so interesting, where Facebook changed the feed, the posts that you would see on your page. Some people would see more negative posts and some people would see more positive posts, and then they watched those people's posts become more negative or more positive depending on what kinds of things they were seeing in their feed.
Yes, absolutely. So people organize, they self-organize in one direction or another in that way. But the thing that's interesting is that if you have that group remembering an event that they all experienced, a year ago, the thing that's important about that phenomenon, the Facebook experiment that you just described, is that what you're feeling right now will determine a lot about what you remember about what happened back then.
Right. Sure. Right?
So almost any time you're remembering, what's happening now impacts what you remember.
It can't be divorced from what your current experience is.
Really hard to do. Really hard to do.
Right.
That's why we should be videotaping interrogations. That's why, you know, all of these kinds of things that happen, we need an objective document to the extent possible, because we are not good at keeping those things in our
heads. Well, memory changes over time, right? It changes with retelling. So
yeah.
One of the problems that I have seen is when you look at the DNA exonerations in some of the eyewitness cases, you'll have someone who has identified X person as their rapist or assailant.
Yeah.
And then they'll be shown that person in court, right? Maybe they've seen a photo lineup.
Yeah.
Right? And they've picked out this picture.
Yeah.
And they think that might have been the guy, right? Because they're looking at 6 or 8 or 12 pictures, and they decide there's a pressure or a sense that you need to pick one of them. And
yeah.
Even if you say to people, this guy might not be in these pictures, right? There's still this sort of sense that this is the universe of possibilities and
yep.
you should pick one. And then by the time they get to court and the person's there in the courtroom, they're very sure that
yeah.
that person
oh, yeah.
is the person who did it. Why? Why does their level of certainty change?
It's the same process as those little booklets that I created for my brother 25 years ago. You know, you hold it in mind. And when you hold it in mind, you are in the process of incorporating it into your memory.
Mm-hmm. And I wonder if sometimes by the time you get to court and the person is expressing that certainty, if the certainty they're expressing is really informed by the fact that they're certain that person sitting at the defense table is the person in the picture.
Yeah.
yeah. More so than remembering what
yeah.
actually happened.
And the really insidious thing is that at the very earliest stages. So the other thing is about perception is that it's active. It's not passive. We're not just sitting there waiting for the thing. We are looking for the thing that we expect.
Mm-hmm.
And that also saves us time.
This is why you have people who see the middle-class white guy rob the bank and decide it was a black kid in a hoodie.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, this has happened to me. You know, it's probably happened to you. Maybe people who are listening have had this experience. You know, I have discovered some pretty ugly biases in my own self
mm-hmm.
because I have taken a moment more to question what I think I just saw
mm-hmm.
and found that I didn't see that at all. I saw something completely different. And it's disconcerting. And
gotcha.
It should be. Don't you think?
I do. I think it should be very disconcerting. But
yeah.
But what do you do? I mean, you know, we don't have too much time left, but just briefly, I mean, okay, so let's say that you're right about these things,
yeah.
right? That memories can be created, and the person who is remembering them can come to believe that, in fact, they are real and they are what happened, and that you have this kind of feedback loop
yeah.
in the recreation of memory. How should the legal system deal with this? I mean, you still have a crime that got committed. Somebody robbed the bank, and you still have the witnesses you have who
yeah.
saw the person that robbed the bank. What do you do?
Well, I mean, you know, I'm not a lawyer. I'm not a policeman. I'm not a prosecutor. I don't know. But at the very least, what we should all be doing is being aware of this research. We should be really aware of how memory is likely to be organized, how perception is likely to work. Because if we're not, we're going to make serious mistakes. Folk beliefs about memory are wrong.
Folk beliefs?
Yeah, folk beliefs. You know, ideas that memory is like a tape recorder, or, you know, that it, once it's in there, it's there forever, and it's not, you know, it can't be, you know, altered or changed. These kinds of beliefs about memory, they're just not accurate.
Gotcha. Well, I think we're going to leave it on that note. Thank you so much, Jim.
Thanks for having me in.
I really appreciate it. It was really kind of a neat topic to talk about. This is Andre Hakes. I am signing off for Straight Talk, and we'll see you next week.
This has been Straight Talk with your host, Andre Hakes, brought to you by Tucker Griffin Barnes. Production is from Olivia August, engineering, Mike Friend. Be sure and listen again next Saturday morning at 10 o'clock for Straight Talk on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville.